The obvious contradiction lies in their choice of words, which imply that man and his artifacts are not part of nature, but beavers and their dams are. But the contradictions go deeper than this prima facie absurdity. In declaring his love for a beaver dam erected by beavers for beavers' purposes, and his hatred for dams erected by men for the purposes of men, the naturist reveals his hatred for his own race, i.e. his own self-hatred. In the case of naturists, such self-hatred is understandable. They are a sorry lot. But hatred is too strong an emotion to feel toward them. Pity and contempt are the most they rate. As for me, willy-nilly, I am a man, not a beaver, and Homo sapiens is the only race I have or can have. Fortunately for me, I like being part of a race made up of men and women. It strikes me as a fine arrangement and perfectly natural. Believe it or not, there were naturists who opposed the first flight to old Earth's moon as being unnatural and a despoiling of nature. No man is an island. Much as we may feel and act as individuals, our race is a single organism, always growing and branching, which must be pruned regularly to be healthy. This necessity need not be argued. Anyone with eyes can see that any organism which grows without limit always dies in its own poisons. The only rational question is whether pruning is best done before or after birth. Being an incurable sentimentalist, I favor the former of these methods. Killing makes me queasy, even when it's a case of he's dead and I'm alive, and that's the way I wanted it to be. But this may be a matter of taste. Some shamans think that it is better to be killed in a war, or to die in childbirth, or to starve in misery, than never to have lived at all. They may be right. But I don't have to like it, and I don't. Democracy is based on the assumption that a million men are wiser than one man. How's that again? I missed something. Autocracy is based on the assumption that one man is wiser than a million men. Let's play that over again, too. Who decides? Any government will work if authority and responsibility are equal and coordinate. This does not ensure good government. It simply ensures that it will work. But such governments are rare. Most people want to run things, but want no part of the blame. This used to be called the backseat driver syndrome. What are the facts? Again and again and again, what are the facts? Shun wishful thinking. Ignore divine revelation. Forget what the stars foretell. Avoid opinion. Care not what the neighbors think. Never mind the unguessable verdict of history. What are the facts? And to how many decimal places? You pilot always into an unknown future. Facts are your single clue. Get the facts. Stupidity cannot be cured with money, or through education, or by legislation. Stupidity is not a sin. The victim can't help being stupid. But stupidity is the only universal capital crime. The sentence is death. There is no appeal. An execution is carried out automatically and without pity. God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. It says so right here on the label. If you have a mind capable of believing all three of these divine attributes simultaneously, I have a wonderful bargain for you. No checks, please. Cash, and in small bills. Courage is the complement of fear. A man who is fearless cannot be courageous. He is also a fool. The two highest achievements of the human mind are the twin concepts of loyalty and duty. Whenever these twin concepts fall into disrepute, get out of there fast. You may possibly save yourself, but it is too late to save that society. It is doomed. People who go broke in a big way never miss any meals. It is the poor jerk who is shy, a half-slug, who must tighten his belt. The truth of a proposition has nothing to do with its credibility, and vice versa. Anyone who cannot cope with mathematics is not fully human. At best, he is a tolerable subhuman who has learned to wear shoes, bathe, and not make messes in the house. Moving parts and rubbing contact require lubrication to avoid excessive wear. Honorifics and formal politeness provide lubrication where people rub together. Often the very young, the untraveled, the naive, the unsophisticated deplore these formalities as empty, meaningless, or dishonest, and scorn to use them. No matter how pure their motives, they thereby throw sand into machinery that does not work too well at best. A human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects. The more you love, the more you can love, and the more intensely you love. Nor is there any limit on how many you can love. If a person had time enough, he could love all of that majority who are decent and just. Masturbation is cheap, clean, convenient, and free of any possibility of wrongdoing. And you don't have to go home in the cold. But it's lonely. Beware of altruism. It is based on self-deception, the root of all evil. If tempted by something that feels altruistic, examine your motives and root out that self-deception. Then, if you still want to do it, wallow in it. The most preposterous notion that Homo sapiens has ever dreamed up is that the Lord God of creation, shaper and ruler of all the universes, wants the saccharine adoration of his creatures, can be swayed by their prayers, and becomes petulant if he does not receive this flattery. Yet this absurd fantasy, without a shred of evidence to bolster it, pays all the expenses of the oldest, largest, and least productive industry in all history. The second most preposterous notion is that copulation is inherently sinful. Writing is not necessarily something to be ashamed of, but do it in private and wash your hands afterwards. $100 placed at 7% interest compounded quarterly for 200 years will increase to more than $100 million. By which time it will be worth nothing. Dear, don't bore him with trivia or burden him with your past mistakes. The happiest way to deal with a man is never to tell him anything he does not need to know. Darling, a true lady takes off her dignity with her clothes and does her whorish best. At other times you can be as modest and dignified as your persona requires. Everybody lies about sex. If men were the automatons that behaviorists claim they are, the behaviorist psychologists could not have invented the amazing nonsense called behaviorist psychology. So they are wrong from scratch. as clever and as wrong as phlogiston chemists. The shamans are forever yakking about their snake oil miracles. I prefer the real McCoy, a pregnant woman. If the universe has any purpose more important than topping a woman you love and making a baby with her hearty help, I've never heard of it. Thou shalt remember the 11th commandment and keep it holy. A touchstone to determine the actual worth of an intellectual? Find out how he feels about astrology. Taxes are not levied for the benefit of the taxed. There is no such thing as social gambling. Either you are there to cut the other bloke's heart out and eat it, or you're a sucker. If you don't like this choice, don't gamble. When the ship lifts, all bills are paid. No regrets. The first time I was a drill instructor, I was too inexperienced for the job. The things I taught those lads must have got some of them killed. War is too serious a matter to be taught by the inexperienced. A competent, self-confident person is incapable of jealousy in anything. Jealousy is invariably a symptom of neurotic insecurity. Money is the sincerest of all flattery. Women love to be flattered, and so do men. You live and learn, or you don't live long. Whenever women have insisted on absolute equality with men, they have invariably wound up with the dirty end of the stick. What they are and what they can do makes them superior to men, and their proper tactic is to demand special privileges. All the traffic will bear. They should never settle merely for equality. For women, equality is a disaster. Peace is an extension of war by political means. Plenty of elbow room is pleasanter and much safer. One man's magic is another man's engineering. Supernatural is a null word. The phrase we, I, you, simply must designate something that need not be done. That goes without saying is a red warning. Of course, means you had best check it yourself. These small change cliches, and others like them, when read correctly, are reliable channel markers. Do not handicap your children by making their lives easy. Rub her feet. If you happen to be one of the fretful minority who can do creative work, never force an idea. You'll abort it if you do. Be patient, and you'll give birth to it when the time is ripe. Learn to wait. Never crowd youngsters about their private affairs, sex especially. When they are growing up, they are nerve ends all over and resent, quite properly, any invasion of their privacy. Oh, sure, they'll make mistakes, but that's their business, not yours. You made your own mistakes, did you not? Never underestimate the power of human stupidity. Variations on a theme. 11. The Tale of the Adopted Daughter. Stand with me on man's old planet, gazing north when sky is darkened. Follow down the dipper's handle, half again and veering leftward. Do you see it? Can you sense it? Nothing there but cold and darkness. Try again with both eyes covered. Try once more with inner vision. Hearken now to wild geese honking, sounding through the endless spaces, bouncing off the strange equations. There, it glistens. Hold your vision. Warp your ship through crumpled space. There, it glistens. Hold your vision. Warp your ship through crumpled spaces. Gently. Gently, do not lose it. Virgin planet. New beginnings. Woodrow Smith, of many faces, many names, and many places, led this band to new beginnings. Planet clean and bright as morning. End of line, he told his shipmates. Endless miles of untouched prairie. Endless stands of uncut timber. Winding rivers. Soaring mountains. Hidden wealth and hidden dangers. Here is life, or here is dying. Only sin is lack of trying. Grab your picks and grab your shovels. Dig latrines and build your hovels. Next year better, next year stronger, next year's furrows that much longer. Learn to grow it. Learn to eat it. You can't buy it. Learn to make it. How'd you know until you've tried it? Try again and keep on trying. Ernest Gibbons, a.k.a. Woodrow Wilson, sometimes known as Lazarus Long et al., president of New Beginnings Bank of Commerce, walked out of the Waldorf dining room. He stood on the veranda, picking his teeth and looking over the busy street scene. Half a dozen saddled mules and a loper, muzzled, were hitched just below him. Up the street to the right, a mule train from out back was unloading at the dock of the Top Dollar Trading Post, E. Gibbons' proprietor. A dog lay in the dust in the middle of the street. Mounted traffic went around him. Across the street to his left, a dozen children played some noisy game in the yard of Mrs. Mayberry's primary school. He could count 37 people without moving from that spot. What a change 18 years had made. Top Dollar was no longer the only settlement, or even the largest. New Pittsburgh was larger and dirtier, and both Separation and Junction were large enough to be called towns. This from only 2 shiploads, and in a colony that had almost starved its first winter. He did not like to think about that winter. That one family. Cannibalism had not actually been proved. Still, it was just as well that they were all dead. Forget it. The weak ones died, and the bad ones died, or were killed. The stock that survived was always stronger, smarter, more decent. New Beginnings was a planet to be proud of, and it would get better and better and better for a long time. Still, almost 20 years was long enough to stay in one place. It was time to ship out again. In many ways, it had been more fun when he and Andy, God rest his sweet, innocent soul, had gone banging around the stars together, lining up real estate and never staying longer than necessary to assess potentialities. He wondered if his son, Zachor, would be back on time with a third load of hopefuls. He lifted his kilt and scratched above his right knee, checked his blaster, hitched at the belt band on the left, checked his needle gun, scratched the back of his neck, made sure of his second throwing knife. Ready to face the public, he considered whether to go to his desk at the bank or to the trading post and check that incoming shipment. Neither appealed to him. One of the hitched mules nodded at him. Gibbons looked at him, then said, "Hey, Buck, how are you, boy? Where's your boss?" Buck closed his lips tightly, then said explosively, "Pank!" That settled one point. If Clyde Lemur had hitched here instead of in front of the bank, it meant that Clyde intended to use the side door and was looking for another loan. Let's see what effort he makes to find me. Skip the trading post, too. Not only would Clyde look there next, but it wasn't fair to make Rick nervous by showing up before he had time to steal his usuals. Good storekeepers were hard to come by. Rick was always honest. 5%, no more, no less. Gibbons felt in his shirt pocket, found a sweet, gave it to Buck on the flat of his hand. The mule took it neatly, nodded thanks. Gibbons reflected that these mutant mules, fertile and breeding true, were the biggest help to colonizing since the Libby Drive. They took cold sleep easily. When you shipped swine, half your breeding stock arrived as pork. And they could look out for themselves in many ways. A mule could stomp a wild loper to death. He said, "So long, Buck. Going for a walk. Walk. Tell boss."
"So long,"
acknowledged the mule.
"Bye."
Gibbons turned left and headed out of town while considering how big a loan to offer Clyde Lemur, with Buck as security. A good-tempered, smart stallion mule was a prize, and about the only unmortgaged asset Clyde had left. Gibbons had no doubt that a loan on Buck would put Clyde back on his feet, literally, as soon as the loan was due. Gibbons felt no pity. A man who couldn't cut the mustard on new beginnings was worthless. No sense in propping him up. "No, don't lend Clyde a dollar. Offer to buy outright at 10% over a fair price. A decent, hard-working animal should not belong to a lazy bum. Gibbons had no need for a saddle mule, but it would do him good to ride an hour or so each day." Man got flabby sitting in a bank. Marry again and give Buck to his bride as a wedding present. A pleasant thought, but the only Howards on planet were married couples, and not one with a husband-high daughter, as well as all being in masquerade until the place grew populous enough that the families would set up a clinic here. Safer. Once burned, forever shy. He avoided Howards, and they avoided each other, on the surface. Be nice to be married again, though. The McGee family, actually Barstow's, had two or three girls growing up. Maybe you should pay them a call someday. In the meantime, he felt gutsy and good, stuffed with scrambled eggs and wicked thoughts, and wondered where there was a female who felt the same way and could duck out and share their interest. Ernie knew several who shared his enthusiasm, but not available at this time of day, not for a casual romp. Which was all he wanted. It was not fair to engage in anything serious with an ephemeral, no matter how sweet she was, especially if she was truly sweet. Banker Gibbons was at the edge of town and about to turn back when he noticed smoke from a house farther out, the Harper Place. What had been the Harper Place, he amended, before they homesteaded out back, but now occupied by, Bud Brandon and his wife, Margie. Nice young couple from the second shipload. One child? He thought so. Running a fireplace on a day like this? Possibly burning trash. Hey, that smoke is not from the chimney. Gibbons broke into a run. As he reached the Harper Place, the entire roof was burning. Lazarus skidded to a stop and tried to judge the situation. Like most older houses, the Harper Place had no ground floor windows, and but a single door that fit tightly and opened outward, a design for a time when lopers and dragons were ubiquitous. Opening that door would be opening the damper on a burning fire. He did not waste an instant debating it. The door must stay closed. He ran around the house, spotting windows of the upper floor and looking for means to reach one. A ladder or anything. Was anyone inside? Didn't the Brandons even have knotted rope fire escapes? Probably not. Good rope came from Earth and retailed at $90 a meter. The Harpers would not have left any behind. A window with its shutters open and smoke pouring out. He yelled, "Hey! Anybody home?" A figure showed at the window and something was thrown out to him. Automatically, he made a good catch, spotting what it was while in the air, going to the ground with it to soften the impact. A small child. He looked up, saw an arm hanging over the windowsill. The roof fell in. The arm disappeared. Gibbons scrambled up fast, holding the little boy, No, little girl, he corrected, and moved hastily back from the Holocaust. He did not consider the possibility that someone might be alive in that raging fire. He simply hoped that they had died quickly and gave it no more thought. He cradled the child in his arms. Are you all right, honey?
I guess so,
she answered, then added gravely,
but Mama's awful sick.
Mama's all right now, dear, he said gently, and so is Papa.
You're sure?
The child twisted in his arms, tried to see the burning house. He interposed his shoulder.
I'm sure.
He held her more firmly and started walking. Halfway back to town, they encountered Clyde Lemur, mounted on Buck. Clyde reined up.
Ah, there you are. Banker, I want to talk to you.
Stow it, Clyde.
Huh? But you don't understand. I've got to have some money. Nothing but bad luck the whole season. Seems like everything I touch...
Clyde, shut your yap.
What?
Lemur seemed to notice for the first time that the banker was carrying something.
Hey, ain't that the Brandon kid?
Yes.
Thought so. Now about this loan...
I told you to shut up. The bank won't lend you another dollar.
But you gotta listen. Seems to me the community ought to help a farmer who's had bad luck. If it weren't for the farmers...
You listen. If you spend as much time working as you do talking, you wouldn't need to talk about bad luck. Even your stable is dirty. What price do you want for that stud brute?
Buck? Why, I wouldn't sell Buck. But here's what I had in mind, banker. You're a kindly man, even if you do talk rough, and I know you won't see my kid starve. Now, Buck is a valuable property, and I figure he ought to be security for about, well, about, say...
Clyde, the best thing you can do for your kids is to cut your throat. Then people would adopt them. No loan, Clyde. Not a dollar, not a dime. But I'll buy Buck myself right now. Name a price.
Lemur gulped and hesitated. 25,000? Gibbons started walking toward town. Lemur said hastily,
20,000!
Gibbons did not answer. Lemur reined the mule around, turned in front of the banker, and stopped.
Banker, you got me by the short hairs. 18,000 and you're stealing them.
Lemur, I won't steal them from you.
Put him up for auction, and I might bid. Or might not. How much do you think he'll bring at auction?
15,000?
You think so? I don't. I know how old he is without looking at his teeth, and just what you paid for him, off the ship. I know what people around here can afford and will pay. But go ahead, he's yours. Bear in mind that if you put a low bid price against him, you're the auctioneer 10%, even if he doesn't sell. But it's your business, Clyde. Now get out of my way. I want to get this child into town and lying down. She's had a bad time.
What will you pay?
12,000.
Why, that's robbery!
You don't have to take it. Suppose an auction brings $15,000, as you hope. Your net is 13,500. But suppose an auction brings only 10,000, which I find more likely. You net 9,000. Goodbye, Clyde. I'm in a hurry.
Well, 13,000?
Clyde, I name my top price. You dealt with me often enough to know that when I say it's top dollar, then it's top dollar. But throw in that saddle and bridle and answer one question, and I'll sweeten it by $500.
What question?
How did you happen to migrate?
Lemur looked startled, then laughed unmirthfully.
Because I was crazy, if you want to know the truth. Aren't we all?
That's hardly an answer, Clyde.
Well, my old man is a banker, and as hard-nosed as you are, I was doing all right. I had a proper, respectable job, teaching, college. But the pay wasn't much, and my old man was always snotty about it when I ran a little short.
snoopy, disparaging. Finally, I got so sick of it that I asked him what he would think of paying Yvonne's fare and mine and the Andy J. Migrate. Be mine and the Andy J. Migrate. Be rid of us. To my surprise, he agreed, but I didn't back out. I knew that a man with a fine education like mine could get ahead anywhere, and it wasn't like we was being dumped on some wild planet. We were second wave, you may remember. Only it was a wild planet, and I've had to do things that no gentleman ought to have to touch. But you just wait, banker. Kids around here are growing up, and there will be a place for higher education. Not the trivia Mrs. Mayberry teaches in that so-called school of hers. That's where I come in. You'll be calling me professor yet, and speaking respectfully. You'll see. Good luck to you. Are you accepting my offer? $12,500 net, including bridle and saddle? I said I was, didn't I? You didn't say. You still have not. I accept. The girl child had listened quietly, face serious. Gibbons said to her, "Can you stand up a moment, dear?"
"Yes."
He put her down. She trembled and held on to his kilt. Gibbons dug into his sporran, then using Buck's broad rump as a desk, wrote a draft and a bill of sale. He handed them to Lemur. "Take that to Hilda at the bank. Sign the bill of sale and give it back to me." Silently, Lemur signed, looked at the draft and pocketed it, handed over the bill of sale. "Thanks, banker, you old skinflint. What do you want him delivered?" "You've delivered him. Dismount." "Huh? How do I get to the bank? How am I supposed to get home?" "You walk." "What? Will, of all the sneaky, underhanded tricks, you get the mule when I get the cash at the bank." "Lemur, I paid top dollar for that mule because I need him now. But I see that we did not have a meeting of minds. Okay, hand back my draft, and here's your bill of sale." Lemur looked startled. "Oh, no, you don't. You made a deal." "Then get off my mule. At once." Gibbons just happened to rest his hand on the handle of the all-purpose knife every man carried. "And dog trot into town, and you'll be there before Hilda closes. Now move." His eyes, cold and blank, held Lemur's. "Can't you take a joke?" Lemur grumbled as he swung down. He started walking rather fast toward town. "Oh, Clyde." Lemur stopped. "What do you want now?" "If you see the volunteer fire team headed this way, tell them it's too late. The Harper place is gone. But tell McCarthy I said it wouldn't hurt to send a couple of men to check."
"Okay, okay."
"And Clyde, what was it you used to teach?"
"Teach? Oh, I taught creative writing. I told you I had a good education."
"So you did. Better hurry. Hilda closes promptly. She has to pick up her kids at Mrs. Mayberry's school." Gibbons ignored Lemur's answer, picked up the little girl, then said, "Steady, Buck. Stand still, old fella." He swung the child high, settled her gently astride the mule's withers. "Hang on to his mane." He towed the left stirrup, swung up behind her, scooted back in the saddle, then lifted her again and placed her somewhat in his lap, but mostly in the saddle just back of the pommel. "Hang on to the horn, dear. Both hands. Comfortable?"
"This is fun."
"Lots of fun, baby girl. Buck, hear me, boy?" The mule nodded. "Walk. Walk back to town. Slow walk. Steady. Don't stub your feet. Get me? I'm not going to use the reins."
"Shrock."
"Right, Buck." Gibbons took a hitch in the reins, let them fall loosely on Buck's neck, squeezed the mule with his knees, let him go. Buck ambled toward town.
After a few minutes, the little girl said gravely,
"What about Mama and Daddy?"
"Mama and Daddy are all right. They know I'm taking care of you. What's your name, dear?"
Dora.
"That's a nice name, Dora. A pretty name. Do you want to know my name?"
"That man called you Banker."
"That's not my name, Dora. That's just something I do sometimes. My name is, Uncle Gibby. Can you say that?"
"Uncle Gibby. That's a funny name."
"So it is, Dora. And this is Buck we are riding. He's a friend of mine, and he'll be your friend, too, now. So say hello to Buck."
"Hello, Buck."
"Hello, Dora."
"Say, he talks lots plainer than most mules, doesn't he?"
"Buck is the best mule on New Beginnings, Dora. And the smartest. When we get rid of this bridle, Buck doesn't need a bit in his mouth. He'll be able to talk plainer still, and you can teach him more words. Would you like that?"
"Oh, yes," Dora added, "if Mama lets me."
"It's all right with Mama. Do you like to sing, Dora?"
"Oh, sure. I know a clapping song, but we can't clap right now, can we?"
"Right now, I think we'd better hang on tight."
Gibbons rapidly reviewed in his mind his repertoire of happy songs, rejected a round dozen as unsuitable for young ladies.
"How about this one? There's a pawn shop on the corner where I usually keep my overcoat." "Can you sing that, Dora?"
"Oh, that's easy."
The baby girl sang it in a voice so high that Gibbons was reminded of a canary.
"Is that all, Uncle Gibby? And what's a pawn shop?"
"It's a place to keep overcoats when you don't need them. Lots more, Dora. Thousands and thousands of verses."
"Thousands and thousands? Well, that's almost as much as 100, isn't it?"
"Almost, Dora. Here's another verse. There's a trading post by the pawn shop where my sister sells candy." "Do you like candy, Dora?"
"Oh, yes, but Mama says it's expensive."
"Won't be so expensive next year, Dora. There'll be more sugar beets cropped. But, open your mouth and close your eyes, and I'll give you something for a surprise."
He felt around in his shirt pocket and said, "Oh, sorry, Dora. The surprise will have to wait until I can get to the trading post. Buck got the last one. Buck likes candy, too."
"He does?"
"Yes, and I'll teach you how to give it to him without losing a finger by mistake. But candy isn't too good for him, so he gets it only as a special surprise for being a good boy. Okay, Buck?"
"Okay. Pause."
Mrs. Mayberry's school was letting out as Gibbons halted Buck in front of it. When he lifted Dora down, she seemed very tired, so he picked her up again.
"Wait, Buck."
The stragglers among the pupils stared, but separated and let him through.
"Afternoon, Mrs. Mayberry."
Gibbons had gone there almost by instinct. The schoolmistress was a gray-haired widow, 50 or more, who had outlasted 2 husbands, and was coping sensibly with her meager chance of finding a third, preferring to support herself rather than live with one of her daughters, stepdaughters, or daughters-in-law. She was one who shared Ernest Gibbons' enthusiasm for the hearty pleasures in life, but was as circumspect about it as he was. He considered her sensible in every way, a prime prospect for marriage, were it not for the unfortunate fact that they ran on different time rates. Not that he let her know this. He had not been a disclosed Howard when they both had arrived in the first shipload, and although freshly rejuvenated on Secundus when he had reappeared on Earth and organized the migration, he had elected to be 35 or so, cosmetically. Since that time, he had carefully aged himself each year. Helen Mayberry thought of him as a contemporary, returned his friendship, shared mutual pleasure with him from time to time without trying to own him. He respected her highly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gibbons.
Why, it's Dora. I missed you, dear.
What happened? And is that a bruise?
She looked closely, said nothing about the fact that the little girl was filthy dirty. She straightened up.
Seems to be just a smudge. I'm glad to see her. I fretted a little this morning when she didn't show up with the Parkinson children. It's almost Marjorie Brandon's time. Perhaps you knew.
Vaguely. Where can I put Dora down for a few minutes? Conference, private. Mrs. Mayberry's eyes widened slightly, but she answered at once.
The couch.
No, put her on my bed. She led the way, said nothing about getting her white coverlet dirty. Went back into the schoolroom with him after he assured Dora that they would be gone only a few moments. Gibbons explained what had happened.
Dora doesn't know that her parents are dead. Helen, nor do I think it's time to tell her.
Mrs. Mayberry considered it.
Ernest, are you sure they both died?
Bud would have seen the fire if he had been, working his own fields. But he sometimes works for Mr. Parkinson.
Helen, that was not a woman's hand I saw. Unless Margie Brandon has thick black hair on the back of her hands.
No. No, that would be Bud.
She sighed.
Then she's an orphan. Poor little Dora. A nice child, bright, too.
Helen, can you take care of her a few days? Will you?
Ernest, the way you phrase that is almost offensive. I will take care of Dora as long as I am needed.
Sorry. I didn't mean to phrase it unpleasingly. I don't expect it to be long. Some family will adopt her. In the meantime, keep track of your expense. Then we'll work out what her room and board should be.
Ernest, that will come to exactly zero. The only cost will be about enough food to feed a bird, which I can certainly do for Marjorie Brandon's little girl.
So? Well, I can find some family to board her. The lemurs. Someone.
Ernest!
Get your feathers down, Helen. That child was placed in my hands, her father's last dying act. And don't be a dumb fool. I know to the penny how much you managed to save, as well as how often you have to take tuition in food rather than cash. This is a cash deal. The lemurs would jump at it, as well as several others. I don't have to leave Dora here, and won't unless you are sensible.
Mrs. Mayberry looked grim, then suddenly smiled and looked years younger.
Ernest, you're a bully. And a bastard. And other things I never say out of bed.
All right. Room and board.
And tuition, plus any special expenses. Doctor's bills, maybe.
Triple bastard. You always pay for anything you get, don't you?
As I should know. She glanced at the unshuttered windows.
Step out here in the hall and seal it with a kiss, bastard.
They moved. She placed herself so that the angle did not permit anyone to see them, then delivered a kiss that would have astounded her neighbors.
Helen.
She brushed her lips against his.
The answer is no, Mr. Gibbons.
Tonight I'll be busy reassuring a baby girl.
I was about to say, don't give her that bath I know you intend to until I get hold of Doc Krausmeier and have him examine her. She seems all right, but she may have anything from broken ribs to a skull concussion. Oh, get her clothes off and sponge her a little for the worst of the dirt. That won't hurt her, and it will make it easier for Doc to examine her.
Yes, dear. Get your lecherous hands off my bottom, and I'll get to work. You'll find Doc.
Right away, Mrs. Mayberry.
Until later, Mr. Gibbons. Au revoir.
Gibbons told Buck to wait, walked over to the Waldorf, found, as he expected, Dr. Krausmeier at the bar. The physician looked up from his drink.
Ernest, what's this I hear about the Harbor Place? What's this I hear about the Harbor Place?
What do you hear about it?
Put down that glass and grab your bag, emergency.
Now, I haven't seen the emergency yet. That wouldn't leave time to finish a drink. Clyde Lima was just in and bought us a round of drinks. Bought this one you, urged me to abandon. And told us that the Harper Place had burned and killed the whole Brandon family. Says he tried to rescue them, but it was too late.
Gibbons briefly considered the desirability of a fatal accident happening to both Clyde Lemur and Doc Krausmeier some dark night. But damn it, while Clyde would be no loss if Doc died, Gibbons would be forced to hang out his own shingle, and his diplomas did not read Ernest Gibbons. Besides, Doc was a good doctor when sober. And anyhow, it's your own fault, old son. 20 years ago, you interviewed him and okayed the subsidy. All you saw was a bright young intern and failed to spot the incipient lush.
Now that you mention it, Doc, I did see Clyde hurrying toward the Harbor Place. If he says he was too late to save them, I would have to back his story. However, it was not the whole family. Their little girl Dora was saved.
Well, yes, Clyde did say that. He said it was her parents he couldn't save.
That's right. It's the little girl I want you to attend. She's suffering from multiple abrasions and contusions, possibly broken bones, possible internal injuries, a strong possibility of smoke poisoning, and a certainty of extreme emotional shock. Very serious in a child that age. She's across the street at Mrs. Mayberry's place.
He added softly, I think you ought to hurry, Doctor. I really do. Don't you? Dr. Krausmeier looked unhappily at his drink, then straightened up and said,
Mine host, if you will be so kind as to put this on the back of the bar, I shall return.
He picked up his bag. Dr. Krausmeier found nothing wrong with the child, gave her a sedative. Gibbons waited until Dora was asleep, then went to arrange temporary board for his mule. He went to Jones Brothers. Fine stock, mules bought, sold, traded, auctioned, registered stallions standing at stud, because his bank held a mortgage on their place.
It wasn't planned, it just grew. I expected Dora to be adopted in a few days, a few weeks, some such. Pioneers don't feel about kids the way city people do. If they didn't like kids, they wouldn't have the temperament to pioneer. And as soon as pioneer kids stop being babies, the investment starts paying off. Kids are an asset in pioneer country. I certainly did not plan to raise an ephemeral, or hold any fear that it would be necessary. Nor was it necessary. I was beginning to simplify my affairs, expecting to leave soon, as my son Zachar should show up any year. Zach was my partner then, in a loose arrangement based on mutual trust. He was young, a century and a half or such, but steady and smart. Out of Phyllis Briggs Sperling, by my last marriage, but two. A fine woman, Phyllis, as well as a number one mathematician. We made 7 children together, and every one of them smarter than I am. She married several times. I was her 4th. Footnote. 5th. James Matthew Libby was her 4th. Justin Foote the 45th. And as I recall, the first woman to win the Ira Howard Memorial Century Medal for contributing 100 registered offspring to the families. Took her less than 2 centuries, but Phyllis was a girl of simple tastes. The other being pencil and paper and time to think about geometry. I digress. To engage in the pioneering business profitably takes a mini-max of a suitable ship and 2 partners, both shipmasters, both qualified to mount a migration and lead it. Otherwise, you're taking a shipload of city folks and abandoning them in wilderness, which often happened in the early days of the diaspora. Zach and I did it properly. Each fully qualified as captain in space, or as leader, on a strange planet, taking turns. The one who stays behind when the ship leaves really does pioneer. He can't fake it. He can't just wave the baton. He may not be political head of the colony. I preferred not to be. Talk is so time-consuming. What he does have to be is a survivor, a man who can force that planet to feed him, and by his example show others how, and advise them if they want it. The first wave is a break-even. The captain unloads and goes back for more migrants. The planet offers nothing for export that soon. The trip has been paid for by fares charged to migrants. Profit, if any, will come from the partner on the ground selling what else the ship has carried. Mules, hardware, swine, fertile chicken eggs, to the pioneers, on credit at first. Which means the partner on the ground has to look sharp and mind his rear. It doesn't take much to convince migrants who are having a tough time that this bloke is profiteering and should be lynched. Minerva, the 6 times I did this, let myself be left behind with the first wave of a colony, I never once plowed a field without weapons at hand, and I was always far more cautious with my own breed than I was with any dangerous animals that planet held. But on New Beginnings we were past most such hazards. The first wave had made it, though just barely that terrible first winter. Helen Mabry was not the only widow who had married a widower as a result of a weather cycle that Andy Libby and I had not anticipated. The star there, called the Sun, as always, but you can check your memories for catalog designation. New Beginnings Sun was a variable star by about the amount that Old Soul is, just enough to give unusual weather. And when we arrived, we hit the bad weather jackpot. But those who made it through that winter were tough enough to stand anything. The second wave had a much easier time. I had disposed of my farm to migrants of the second wave and was putting my attention on business and trade to build up a cargo for the Andy J to take back after Zack unloaded the third wave. And I would go back too. Go somewhere, that is. What and where and how would be settled after I saw Zack. In the meantime, I was bored, getting ready to wind up my on-planet affairs, and found this waif an interesting diversion. Delightful, I should say. Dora was a baby who was born grown up, utterly innocent, ignorant in the fashion that a small child necessarily is, but most intelligent and delighted to learn anything. There was no meanness in her anywhere, Minerva, and I found her naive conversation more entertaining than most talk of adults, usually trivial and rarely new. Helen Mabry took as much interest in Dora, and we two found ourselves in loco parentis without planning it. We consulted each other and get the baby girl away from the burial, some charred bones, including tiny ones of the baby that had never been born. I kept her away from the memorial service, too. Some weeks later, when Dora seemed to be in good shape and after I'd had time to have a gravestone cut and erected, I took her out there and let her see it. She could read, and did, names and dates of her parents, and a single date for the baby. She looked it over solemnly, and said, "That means Mama and Daddy won't ever be coming back, doesn't it?" "Yes, Dora. That's what the kids at school said. I wasn't sure." "I know, dear. And Helen told me. So I thought you had better see for yourself." She looked again at the headstone, then said gravely, "I see. I guess I do. Thank you, Uncle Gibby." She didn't cry, so I didn't have any excuse to pick her up and console her. All I could think of to say was, "Do you want to go now, dear?" "Yes." We had ridden out on Buck, but I had left him at the foot of the hill, there being an unwritten rule against letting mules or tamed lopers walk on graves. I asked if she wanted me to carry her, piggyback, perhaps. She decided to walk. Halfway down, she stopped. "Uncle Gibby?" "Yes, Dora." "Let's not tell Buck about this." "All right, Dora. He might cry." "We won't tell him, Dora." She did not say any more until we were back at Mrs. Mayberry's school, and she was very quiet for about 2 weeks, and never mentioned it again to me, nor, I think, to anyone. She never asked to go back there, although we went riding almost every afternoon, and often within sight of the graveyard hill. About 2 Earth years later, the Andy J. arrived, and Captain Zack, my son by Phyllis, came down in the gig to make arrangements for landing the third wave of migrants. We had a drink together, and I told him I was staying over another trip, and why. He stared. "Lazarus, you are out of your mind." I said quietly, "Don't call me Lazarus. That name has had too much publicity." He said, "All right, although there is no one around but our hostess, Mrs. Mayberry, did you say? And she's gone out to the kitchen. Look, Gibbons, I was thinking of making a couple of trips to Secundus. Profit in it, and ways to invest our net on Secundus. Safer than investing on Earth now, things being the way they are." I agreed that he was almost certainly right. "Yes," he said, "but here's the point. If I do, I won't be back this way for, oh, maybe 10 standard years, or longer. Oh, I will if you insist, you're majority shareholder, but you'll be wasting your money and mine, too. Look, Ernest, if you must take care of this kid, though I don't see that it's your obligation, come with me and bring her along. You could put her in school on Earth, as long as you post bond to ensure that she leaves. Or perhaps she could settle on Secundus, although I don't know what the immigration rules are there now. It's been a long time since I've been there." I shook my head. "What's 10 years? I can hold my breath that long. Zack, I want to see this child grow up and able to make it on her own. Married, I hope, but that's her business. But I won't uproot her. She's had one shock of that sort and shouldn't have to soak up another while she's still a child." "On your head be it. You want me back in 10 years? Is that long enough?" "More or less, but don't rush. Take time enough to show a profit. If it takes longer, you'll pick up a better cargo here next time. Something better than food and soft goods." Zack said, "There is nothing better than food to ship to Earth these days. Sometime soon we're going to have to stop touching at Earth. Just trade among the colonies." "As bad as that?" "Pretty bad. They won't learn. What's this about trouble over your bank? Do you need a show of force while the Andy J is overhead?" I shook my head. "Thanks, Captain, but that's not the way to do it. I would have to go along with you. Force is an argument to use when nothing else will do, and the issue is that important. Instead, I'm going to go limp on them." Ernest Gibbons did not worry about his bank account. He never worried over any issue less important than life and death. Instead, he applied his brain to all problems, large and small, as they came along, and enjoyed life. Especially, he enjoyed helping raise Dora. Right after he acquired her, and the mule, Buck, or they acquired him, he discarded the savage curb bit Lemur had used, salvaging the metal, and had the Jones brothers harness maker convert the bridle into a hackamore. He ordered also another saddle, sketching what he wanted and offering a bonus for early delivery. The leather crafter shook his head over that sketch, but delivered. Thereafter, Gibbons and the baby girl rode Buck in a saddle built for two. A man-sized saddle in the usual position, with a tiny saddle with tiny stirrups, an integral part of it, in that forward position where a normal saddle carries a pommel horn. A little wooden arch, leather-covered, curved up from this, a safety bar the child could grab. Gibbons also had this extended saddle fitted with 2 belly bands, more comfortable for the mule, safer on steep trails for riders. They rode that way several seasons, usually an hour or more after school, holding 3-cornered conversations at a walk, or singing as a trio with Buck loudly off-key but always on beat with his gait, acting as a metronome, Gibbons carrying the lead, and Dora learning to harmonize. It was often the pawn shop song, which Dora regarded as her own, and to which she gradually added verses, including one about the paddock next to the schoolhouse where Buck lived. But soon there was too much girl for the tiny forward saddle as Dora grew, straight and slender and tall. Gibbons bought a mare mule after trying 2 others. One was rejected by Buck because she was, so he said, stupid. And the other because she had failed to appreciate a hackamore and tried to run away. Gibbons let Buck pick the third, with advice from Dora, but none from him, and Buck acquired a mate in his paddock, and Gibbons had the stable enlarged. Buck still stood at stud for a fee, but seemed pleased to have Beulah at home. However, Beulah did not learn to sing and talked very little. Gibbons suspected that she was afraid to open her mouth in Buck's presence.